Welcome back to the Open Source Startup Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Robbie from Cowboy Ventures, joined as always by Tim Chen from Essence VC. And today we're super excited to have Jake, who's the CEO of AuthZed, on with us. I had the privilege of meeting with Jake way back when he was raising his seed round, and it's been awesome to watch the company's progress to date. They are an open source authorization platform that scales, and we will learn a lot more about what that is talking to Jake. So welcome, Jake.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So on this podcast, we like to go a little chronological. So we like to start way back at the beginning. Can you talk to us a bit about the founding story for AuthZed and where the idea came from?
Yeah, if we want to get into the founding story and where the idea came from, we have to go even farther back than the start of AuthZed, right? So we're solving a problem that we ourselves have lived. In the past, Joey and I founded a company that built a product called Quay. Quay was the first private Docker registry. This was even before Docker Hub had launched and was a thing. And while building Quay, we did sort of the standard thing. We reached for a toolkit that was available to do our authorization, and we copied a pattern, a paradigm that we had seen. So we had copied the GitHub permissions when we built Quay. And so this was just really basic. There was repositories and there were users, and users had direct access to repositories with a variety of roles. Our very first feature request after we launched Quay was, that's cool, but we also need GitHub style orgs, and we need support for teams, and we need teams to have other teams in them. And like the request just kept coming. And because we had chosen sort of the naive solution where we just reached for a tool that was built into the platform that we were building on top of, it was back to the drawing board for every single feature request. So we were constantly going back and reworking this authorization software and retooling it and rethinking it to keep up with these customer demands. And finally, it came to be the point where there were features that we couldn't even ship because authorization was so difficult and so sensitive. It's a very security sensitive area of the code. There were some features that just weren't worth it from an ROI perspective, right? Like the jeopardy and the investment to be able to ship that feature wasn't going to pay for itself. So we actually just canceled them. Fast forward a little bit, we sold Quay to CoreOS. CoreOS got sold to Red Hat. Red Hat got sold to IBM. Now we went from a two-person company to, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people at IBM. And we're still dealing with this problem day in and day out, right? Every new product that we build, we have to go back and think about what's the model we're going to adopt? How are we going to integrate this with our platform? And so finally, in 2019, Google releases their Zanzibar paper. And I'm about halfway through reading the paper. I like to read all of Google's white papers. I think they're amazing. I'm about halfway through reading the paper and I turn to Joey and I'm like, you know that problem we've been struggling with for like a decade now? This paper solves it. Let's go commercialize this and turn it into a company. And that's kind of what we've been doing ever since.
Yeah, that's actually really amazing. I forgot you actually is part of CoreOS. You know, I was early Mesosphere employee, so we had lots of fun with the team. I think we didn't jump many places. I think obviously the Google Zanzibar paper was definitely one of the ways people kind of get introduced to a solution to the problem, because the problem exists for a long time, but there's many solutions, right? And I think that kind of explains part of it is why you choose Zanzibar, but maybe talk about like why you choose to implement a solution and why do you think it's the right time? Because I think your experience running into this problem, did you go talk to a bunch of others and see exactly the same shape of the problem? Or where you feel like you're early? Just kind of talk about the timing and why you choose to go after this space this way.
Yeah, we had experienced the problem ourselves enough that we sort of had conviction that this was the solution, like to the point where we had spent, you know, multiple days trying to whiteboard what a scalable authorization solution looks like. It's actually pretty easy to come up with something that you can throw in and that works for the first, let's call it up to 1,000 users, something like that. But when you start to think about how to make that flexible, and when you start to think about how to make that scalable so that it can kind of grow with you as your product and as your business grows, that's when it turns into a hard problem. We did go out and talk to other companies and be like, are you struggling with this? And they confirmed what, you know, we probably already knew, that yes, this is a real problem. This is something that we ourselves would have paid for and would have adopted if it were around when we were building Quay. So that's always a really good sign from sort of a product development standpoint. And then, yeah, like Google is the biggest sort of use case of all, right? Like, why did Google spend millions of dollars running this software on thousands of servers, right? They've gone through sort of the whole evolution of the authorization landscape internally. So they started doing something very similar to what we did with Quay, right? It was kind of like every team for themselves kind of authorization. And then they brought order to that by abstracting it out into a library that you could compile in to all of the services and make these things behave the same way. And ultimately, for a number of reasons that they go into in the Zanzibar paper, that approach also wasn't scalable, and it was limiting them for being able to ship these delightful experiences. There's always a workflow that I like to bring up that kind of only happens with Zanzibar. So if you've ever sent an email through Gmail and you send a link to a document and one of the recipients doesn't have access to that document, Gmail will do two things. The first thing is it'll warn you and it'll say, hey, Robbie doesn't have access to this doc. And like, how does it even know that, right? Like, how does Gmail know what access Robbie has to a doc in a completely different part of the company? And the reason they know that is because they're using the Zanzibar service, right? That's one of the fundamental tenets, is that it's a service that everybody can talk to, that everybody can collaborate on. And so it can warn you that this person doesn't have access to it. And then the second thing that it does is it can actually let you remediate that right there within Gmail. You can click a button and share that document with all of the recipients of that email. And that's, again, by going and talking to the centralized permissions API, Zanzibar, you're able to grant that. And Gmail doesn't have to know anything at all about how Google Docs makes those determinations or how those things get set up. It just interacts with the Zanzibar service, and it's kind of on uniform footing with everything else. So that's kind of really why Google built this thing, to be able to ship those kinds of delightful authorization powered experiences. And like, that's the same thing that we would have loved to have been able to do with Quay and with Tectonic and all the things that we've been building along the way, is let's not have to build these things from scratch and imagine how they're implemented and then struggle to scale them when we can just adopt the solution.
Yeah, I think because so many people have experiences with Google products, understanding how good their approach is, like, it's something that I imagine that you already kind of have a good amount of reach on. But I also imagine that there's not a ton of people that are up to date with Google's papers. Like, did you have to convince folks that the Zanzibar approach was the right approach, or was there already enough momentum there where folks were looking for like a product solution that was based on Zanzibar?
Yeah. So we didn't start right away. That's part of it, right? So the paper came out in the summer of 2019, and we didn't start our company until summer of 2020. And this whole time, I'm expecting somebody to come out with this exact idea, right? Because whenever I have an idea, I'm like, other people probably had the same idea. So there's probably 10 other companies that are out there trying to build Zanzibars right now. And by mid-2020, none of them had popped up. Right. And of course, as soon as you start a company, they all start popping out of the woodwork. So during that time, I think there was interest in Zanzibar, but I don't think there were any solutions. There were no solutions for people to go and adopt. So that's when we're like, okay, well, we still strongly believe, right? Like, in this past year, nothing has changed our mind that this is the right way to do authorization. We still strongly believe this is the right way. No one is doing it yet. Maybe it's an intractable problem. Let's try to build a prototype. Let's see if we can do this thing. Let's see if we can put this out into the world. And so we started there, and we were able to do it, and we were able to build services and build prototypes and all this stuff. And we put it out into the world with this thesis that we were going to do it, and we were going to have the one authorization system to power the whole world. Similar to how there's only one Zanzibar inside Google, we're like, okay, there's just going to be one platform and everyone's just going to talk to our API. It's going to be kind of like, Stripe or Twilio or something. That didn't work, right? People didn't want to adopt this 6-month-old startup, put all their trust in it, have all their data commingled with everybody else. But then we got back to our roots. We decided, we're open source people through and through. And we think that if people can see the code and play with it and build conviction and basically, understand what we're trying to accomplish and that we've done this in a thoughtful, thorough way, that will really help our adoption. And so we open sourced our Zanzibar implementation called SpiceDB. And ever since then, it's been off to the races. So there was kind of like those two halves, right? It was like, it needed to be open source, especially once we realized that database was the right paradigm. Nobody wants to adopt closed source databases in, the 2020s. It had to be open source, and it had to be high quality and thorough and faithful to the Zanzibar paper. Once we put those two things together, things just started to really work.
And imagine, like, by working at Quay and CoreOS, like, been really done an amazing job at getting developers the attention and adoption. What have you learned from those experiences that leads you to sort of like help you evangelize and gain developer trust here? And what are things also got you surprised? Either it didn't work or you needed new approaches. Maybe talk about some lessons you kind of carried over and some new ones you learned here, getting adoption here.
So all three founders are software engineers by school and by trade originally. So a lot of that we can shortcut by just asking ourselves, like, what would we buy into? What would we trust? Why would we trust it? How does it feel? And the first iteration of the platform was kind of going against that. So we were kind of saying like, well, you know, we think that we can deliver a lot of value if we just run the whole platform and get everything scaling really nicely. But then when we took a moment to reflect, like, would we ourselves adopt this? And then once we realized that we're using a database paradigm, right? Like we're storing data in a service, we're retrieving data in creative and unique ways. We realized that we probably wouldn't. And so that was one of the learnings. It's like kind of just follow our inner monologue a little bit. The same way we build a service that, you know, we think we need. If we don't think we would like to use it, that's probably true sort of across the board. There was a lot of like, I don't know if you've read the book, The Mom Test, but there was a lot of like people just giving us validation because they believed in us. And they, as second time founders, they thought we were going to succeed. And they would just be like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Go for it. Single service for the whole world. I think that's amazing. But in reality, like those same people weren't turning around and adopting. So we had to sort of take a step back and be like, okay, they're not adopting for the same reasons we wouldn't adopt. Let's fix that. Like, let's fix those things up. So yeah, we kind of use ourselves as a benchmark for what will fly for developers. But then also like developers aren't a monolith, right? There's developers at large orgs have different requirements from developers at small orgs, or different from developers in the EU with like GDPR constraints, or different from developers in APAC, right? Like, they're not a monolith. And we, of course, have to do our like all of our product homework to put things in front of people, see how it feels. I always like to say we're trying to iterate our way to greatness. So build those MVPs, right? Get them in people's hands and see if they adapt, see if they interact with it the way that we think they will. And then just go from there.
Yeah. And open source is a really good place or like format to iterate in. I'm curious because authorization, it's kind of a tricky product to bring to market in the sense that for bigger companies, I imagine they'll all have something in place already. So there's a little bit of a like lifting over to a new system. But then for Zanzibar, if it's really flexibility and scalability, those are problems that are kind of big company problems versus startup problems. So like, where did you kind of find your sweet spot as far as early users? And like, how did you figure out just bringing, because it could be the best approach, but if it's really hard to get folks to implement it, then that I imagine could be one of the hardest problems to bring a new authorization product to market.
Yeah, I think that's where the open source really plays into it as well. So when we built Quay, it was very small. We started with small startups and then we sort of grew with them. And then we built our trust with larger organizations over a period of time. And then we ended up landing Fortune 500s and whatnot, right? So very standard, like start small and grow up the value chain, up market. With this, it was completely different, right? When we open sourced SpiceDB, it was the big companies that were trying it first, right? Because they had the most acute pain, the most acute needs in this authorization space. And so that's when we were like, okay, we have to rethink everything, right? We have to rethink our whole go-to-market strategy. We have to rethink the product, the way we're prioritizing features. Are we focusing on building really quick wins and on-ramps for small startups? Or are we focusing on scalability and reliability for large enterprise organizations? And the types of companies that have come in the door have basically laid out our roadmap for us. To them, reliability, scalability, those are paramount things. And they often start by load testing SpiceDB before we even talk to them, right? So SpiceDB needs to be understandable and scalable and delightful, even without help from our solutions engineers or sales folks. So yeah, we had to rethink everything and we ended up building a completely different company from the last time we did this. So that's been interesting as well.
Yeah. And imagine, like you mentioned, developers, especially like during the CoreOS Quay days, because I'm very familiar with that crowd myself, they're so different than the usual crowd of mass developers out there. Is there anything particular that you think you learned by targeting a much broader set of developers? Because I think this is such a broader set of challenges that everybody is facing. And you have a very particular solution going into market here. Is there any key learnings you learned, even trying to get wider developers to understand and adopt beyond the typical crowd we understand, like the cloud native, you know, the Kubernetes crowd or the Go people, right? There's definitely so much more wider. Maybe share some lessons you learned here too.
I think our playground has been really key to getting people to be able to understand what exactly we're trying to do here. Because then you can develop a model and build conviction for that model without rewriting a bunch of your code. This is very much a platform play with AuthZ and with SpiceDB. So getting people to switch platforms is a very difficult thing. I think everybody will tell you that. But the value is there, right? Like once people adopt a platform, they kind of dig in and they become champions and advocates for that platform. So giving them the playground to build that conviction that they need to do a longer engagement was a huge early win for us. I guess the other thing is that when we did Quay, we were there from the beginning with the whole Docker, which then turned into Kubernetes, which then turned into like CNCF movement. And so we were riding the wave of all of that stuff growing. And so as the archetype of the people who were adopting those technologies changed, that was what was the forcing function for us to change ourselves as a company. Does that make sense? So like, you know, when we started, it was like Docker v0.13 or something. And the only people who were testing Docker v0.13 were startups who had a critical need like ourselves. And so as that went on and as that developed maturity, that was the forcing function. But now we're sort of parachuting in to a problem that already has a huge amount of people who are experiencing the problem. And it can sort of lead to analysis paralysis unless you're very thorough. Like, what should we attack next? Which type of archetype should we try to bring into the fold next? How should we expand our ICP? And so I think that's basically the core of what you're asking is, how do you do that when you're not being constrained in a way that makes the decisions for you? And the answer just goes back to standard good product management practices, right? Listening to people, asking them questions, finding out what their problems are, and then sort of figuring out who is the next adjacent company that looks like the ones that you've already solved the problems for, and then going in and talking to them and listening to them and finding out what their products are. And then taking all of that feedback, all of that information, and turning that into a roadmap that sort of serves the most people the soonest so that you can keep sort of organically expanding your business.
Yeah. And I think one of the most interesting and beneficial parts of having an open source company is you can get much faster and much more feedback from your users early on. But then the flip side of that is you're probably getting so much feedback from so many different users that it could become impossible to determine what the right roadmap is from there. So what have you learned from who to listen to and how to listen to the right feedback from the community to like drive the right roadmap and like kind of find the signal in the noise?
Yeah. At the end of the day, you still have to have conviction in what you're building and what shape it's going to take, right? Like there's that Henry Ford quote about, if I listened to my customers, I would have made faster horses or something like that. So you still, there have to be some sort of immutable or fundamental things that you are trying to accomplish that don't change with the way the wind blows. But sort of the rest of it, you should be flexible and you should listen to your customers. The other thing is, not all customers and users are created equal. You develop relationships with the people who exist in your community. So we have a really active Discord, and I just love watching the discussions that happen there and the kind of feedback that we're getting. But there are people in the Discord who very clearly understand and are aligned with what we're trying to accomplish. And like their feedback just naturally gets more attention than somebody who might drive by, drop in a piece of feedback, and then disappear and we never hear from them again. So yeah, I guess not all feedback is created equal would be the TLDR there.
And so you built SpiceBB and you get larger and then wider companies. People love the playground and they play with it and decide to use you. I'm sure there's going to be challenges to actually adopt you. Like you said, like shipping platforms or shifting platforms, so to speak. Most people probably built their own first, right? I think when I built all my products and looking at all the friends and people, we all have to build our permissioning one way or another. Is there anything particular around really gaining true flip over adoption from your user side? Anything that you require to do something different? Because like Docker Registry of the Worlds, we just kind of have to like be there. There wasn't any other thing really, right? So we just had to be better for performance. But this is really like you said, a shifting. What has been the hardest lessons you learned to trying to like get people to either adopt or incrementally adopt?
Yeah, incremental adoption, it becomes a key part of the strategy, right? Because people don't want to switch platforms without being able to tangibly hold on to some value first. And so helping people think through what their first use case is going to be and what's sort of the like minimum required adoption to address that first use case. And it should be something super difficult, something that they weren't able to do or were struggling to do or would have taken, you know, a year or two to do with what they had. And then coaching them on how to think about migrating over to that first use case and seeing that value. And then once you've got that and once you've proven that it works and that it's giving them the flexibility and the scalability that they need, then you can sort of expand your use cases out from there. We've seen that over and over again. We have also seen people who are just like, hey, we're replatforming the whole company. And we're going to switch to you as part of that. And those things sometimes work, but the incremental adoption path is a much more conservative, reliable, straightforward way to sort of getting your foot in the door and then getting more and more traffic flowing through the service.
So walk us through the trajectory a little bit. So 2021, SpiceDB is released. Was it pretty fast as far as starting to see big companies adopt it? Did you kind of put up pieces of content or like do anything alongside Zanzibar, like folks who wrote the initial paper? What were kind of the things you did to have the project grow early?
Yeah, kickstarting the flywheel is what we talk about. The thing that helped us the most to kickstart the flywheel was we got onto the front page of Hacker News, right? And if you go and look at like our GitHub star chart history, it's like, boop, and then it's sort of like a little bit super linear from there, but there was very much a step function of being on the front page of Hacker News for, I don't know, like 24 hours and all of the discussion that happens there. And, you know, that's how we bootstrapped our Discord community. And then from there, it just goes back to what we've been talking about iterating our way to greatness. The other things that we did that were super effective, I published a video with Papers We Love about Zanzibar, right? So trying to be totally neutral. It's not an ad for SpiceDB or AuthSed, but this is what Zanzibar is and all of the different parts of the paper and how they come together to build this service. And that's been viewed, I don't know, thousands of times at this point. And our blog. Our blog is an incredible source of information. We talk about all of the technical things that go into what we're building and go into what makes Zanzibar so great and scalable and flexible. And among those three things, we constantly get people who are coming in and being like, man, I heard about you on Hacker News. I played with your playground. I read your blog and all your docs. I'm all in, right? Like sometimes those are the very first phone calls, the very first touch point that we get with customers. And we love that, right? It's like such a shortcut, especially with a difficult thing like this.
Being so closely tied to Zanzibar, was there ever a point where you all thought that you wanted to recruit someone that worked on the Zanzibar system at Google? Or like, how do you kind of work with those folks?
We have not tried to recruit anybody who worked on Zanzibar. Some of our competitors have. I worry about it from a non-compete slash legal perspective. I know that some of that stuff is unenforceable and some of that, you know, like you get people switching from like big bank A to big bank B all the time. But I kind of just want to do it in a way that seems very ethical, very clean room. I've taken the information that you put out in the public and recreated, reverse engineered, recreated something based off of that versus trying to get inside information and maybe do things in like a little bit less above the board way. So yeah, long story short, if one of those people just randomly applied to work at the company, like for sure I'd have a conversation, but we're not actively out there trying to recruit or bring them on. And maybe that's naive. I don't know. What do you think?
I think keeping it above board is super important. And who knows? I think as AuthSed continues to grow and get attention, those folks, I'm sure, will be super interested in what you all are doing.
Yeah. Who doesn't want to work on SpiceDB, you know?
Right.
Is pretty already wants me to join already. So actually, I want to go back to the big point about you getting the first big jump, which is getting first page of Hacker News. You were talking to Tailscale. I remember that was also a huge part of their getting their initial assess. And everybody wants to be on the front page of Hacker News. Like, how did you guys do it? Maybe share some of the key things here that got you there.
Yeah, I'm not super sure how we did it. We had two pieces of content prepared. I forget. We thought that it was going to be the GitHub page itself that was going to get picked up by Hacker News. And for some reason, we did not in any way try to coordinate like a voting ring or anything, but maybe the community that we're in is very small. So we're fairly sure that that got picked up by the vote ring detection on HN and kind of like downvoted into oblivion. But then we also had a blog post about what we were doing prepared, and that one got picked up and just ended up on the front page, and it was there for like I say, like 24 hours or something. So yeah, they make it super hard to game, right? Like, and it's good that they do, because that's how Hacker News has high quality content on it day in and day out. And Dan over at Hacker News does a great job keeping the site well moderated and clean and not abused. But yeah, we didn't try to game it or put it out there. We might have tweeted about it and got it picked up from there. But really, by far, the thing that gets you picked up on Hacker News the most is if you're on new, like in the new section, and people who are browsing that see it and upvote it. Like it only takes a few upvotes to start the flywheel. And then once you get onto the front page, that's when things can really start compounding. I wish I had a better way to accomplish that. We also would love to get more of our blog posts on the front page of Hacker News, right? But the same reason that it is valuable, right? Like companies can't just arbitrarily spam it, is the same reason it's hard to get there. And that's, you know, the same reason why everybody wants to be there.
Yeah, it's amazing how many founders we talk to, open source founders in particular, where this is a huge growth engine for them. I'm curious, because there are a lot of different approaches to auth, how you thought about messaging auth said when we kind of introduced you, talked about the open source angle, scalability, Zanzibar. Like, how have you kind of iterated on the messaging to make sure that you get in front of the right folks that this is going to be the right solution for?
Yeah, the biggest things that we've done to iterate on the messaging, the first thing was branding it as a database. You know, that got us in front of platform engineering teams and people who could holistically make decisions about how to do this for the company or make it available for service teams. Sort of the second thing that we did is we focused a lot on making it clear that we're doing application permissions, because we're trying not to get wrapped up into all the like IGA style tools that are coming out. We don't want people coming to us and being like, oh, this is great. You know, how do I use this to do my workforce authorization? How do I use this to build workflows to grant access to things? We're like, you absolutely can use this as the engine to do that. But what we're focusing on here is helping you provide your users with delightful experiences and get to market faster. So just focusing on being app permissions and focusing on being a DB. Those are kind of like subtle things that have put us in front of the right people.
And I always just like to ask this question, because reading all your blog posts and just roughly scanning it, everybody has like a different way of content strategy. It's very, very obvious that you guys are very technical and do a lot of developer related content or very specific. Of course, you know, there's always fun
all three
ones,
founders.
I would always fun ones like, there's going to be fun stories here and there. Why you should do X, why you should do Y. Is there any surprises? Something that actually wasn't really meant for widely popular, but somehow did? Was there anything, something more substantially invested, but surprising also didn't get picked up? Like, I wonder, is there anything that surprised you, even from a content point of view?
One of the biggest surprises was when Sam, who was our first employee, when he joined the team, we were like, do you want one of these newfangled M1 MacBook Pros? At the time, they were like hot off the presses. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll give it a try. And so he onboarded and he wrote a post about onboarding to a remote company in the middle of a pandemic and using one of these new M1 MacBook Pros. And that got picked up by Hacker News. And that was on the front page for like a day or something. And mostly what it was people who were salty and complaining about the fact that it could only drive one external monitor. Like, that was a huge part of the discussion, but it was enough for people, like, because Sam mentioned that in his post. He was like, it only does one external monitor, which isn't great. And that was enough for people to upvote it and to get it on the top of Hacker News. And we were like, you know, it was great. It was supposed to be like a feel good, I'm joining a startup in the middle of a pandemic story, but it got picked up for this one random thing. But that put us in front of a bunch of people. And then we got another little bump out of that. So that was sort of like the random, like, positive surprise. And we have countless examples of where we've written highly technical, highly engaging, super thoughtful pieces, and just nobody cares. So I wish everything that we wrote was a home run, but it just doesn't always work out that way. And I think the way to approach that is to just temper your expectations. And every piece of content that you write becomes a durable asset. It can get backlinks for all time, right? Like, people can browse your blog linearly, although that doesn't happen super often, and they can rediscover it at a later date, or it can attract the crawlers at a later date. So, like, just because it didn't get a huge initial bump doesn't mean it wasn't valuable. And if you approach your content strategy with that, that's the only way to not get demotivated when everything you write doesn't get picked up.
Awesome. I want to talk a little bit about your commercial strategy too. And specifically, at what point in time you decided to focus on that as well as the growth of SpiceDB, because that's one of the struggles that a lot of open source companies have, is you can kind of endlessly focus on growing your community, building kind of out in the open, or you can feel like you're trying to monetize too early. Like, how did you think about what the right way to monetize a project like this was, and then the time when you should start focusing on it?
Well, I'll start by saying I have no idea if we did it right, but we monetized super early. One of the greatest ways to get feedback is to have people pay for a thing. And that was part of the strategy, right? Like, let's put it out there. Like, can this thing deliver value? Can it have life outside of just being an open source project? And so figuring that out really early was important to us as company builders, right? Especially second-time founders. The opportunity cost, a startup is a huge investment just from like a personal time and your available bandwidth. And like, I've got two kids, right? Like a startup is a huge investment, and making sure that you're investing in something that's actually viable was super critical to all three founders. So the easiest way for us to do that was to try to monetize it early. We tried to monetize before we open sourced it, right? I talked about the one platform to rule them all. That said, there's definitely like, you can end up falling into local maxima, right? If you monetize too early and you miss out on some of the bigger, more audacious moves that you would have to make if you didn't have paying customers that you would offend. But like, I think if you really care about your open source users and you have empathy for them, you're also not going to like re-architect the thing every 6 months when you've got open source users who are depending on it. So I also think that's a little bit of a false dichotomy as well. So long story short, we like to monetize early to figure out if there's actually a company here and not just a project. And so that's what we did.
So I think one unique thing about what I see from our website, looking at their products page, I think most of the, even what we just call it database companies today, you either have run it yourself, a playground, and then you have a cloud, right? And then now you have a choice. Do you want to also support like your on-prem sort of like hybrid? But quickly, I can see you have like a licensing self-hosted option as well. I'm curious, like, why these three different factors here? Because I feel like this licensing self-hosted isn't your very typical form factor that we see any sort of even dev tools in general. Talk about why do you have this third option and what got you wanting to have a licensed self-hosted form as well?
I mean, I wouldn't say we want to have it. It's certainly not the hotness, right? It's not the hot business model. Everybody wants to be hosting a cloud. We have it because the sensitivity of our data and the sensitivity of the latency of calling our service, which we address in a variety of ways on our dedicated service, on our cloud services. But based on that, some companies, security teams, or the regulatory environments that they operate in just can't use the cloud service for one reason or another. And so it's again, a thing where it's like, okay, we're trying to monetize and build a sustainable business early. There have been numerous businesses that have built very good sustainable businesses on top of licensing models. Like, we should still support those customers, even if they can't use a thing that we would prefer and that we think that they would prefer, right? Like, we think the cloud offering is better for everybody, but if for one reason or another, they just can't use it, like, we still want to have them as customers and we still want to help them on their journey and make sure that they're successful using our software, right? Because the alternative to having that is to just say, the open source is there, good luck. You know, that doesn't feel great. And that's not how you build a partnership and long-term relationship with these firms. And they're generally skewed to be some of the larger firms out there, right? Think banks, think healthcare companies, right? We want to have relationships with these people. So
we talked about wanting to monetize early as a way to kind of test out if there's like a there from a paid product perspective. With a lot of second-time founders, that's what we hear, is they focus on go-to-market much earlier than they did the first time around. Are there other things that you took from the Quay experience that you're just doing differently earlier or just doing differently in general, like some painful lessons from being a second-time founder?
Yeah, I want to touch on something you just said, which I think is interesting, where you said that second-time founders focus on go-to-market earlier. But shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't it be the first-time founders that need to pay the bills and maybe can't attract the same level of attention? I don't know. That just seems backwards to me.
Definitely does. I think one of the interesting things is I think until you've gone through it, at least this is my perspective on it, you don't appreciate how hard it is to bring a new product to market as a new company that doesn't have the trust, that doesn't have the brand. And especially for technology-oriented founders, like DevTool founders, data founders, they probably haven't done that before. So they lean into what they know, what they've done in the past a lot of times. So at least from my experience, Tim, probably similar. We see a lot of founders that just like to build and they'll just build and build and build and then go to market as like an afterthought. But then if they're lucky enough to do it or crazy enough or whatever to do it a second time around, they're like, oh, wait, that was not the right way to do it.
Yeah, I guess I'll just tell you a little story about my past. I built an iPhone game way back in the early days of iPhone, probably like 2008, 2009, something like that. And I just built a game. It was a Chinese card game. And I just put it into the App Store. And at first, it didn't sell. And then I made it free, right? So this is very similar to the story of Authzed. I made it free. And then all of a sudden, I was getting like hundreds of thousands of downloads per day on this app. And it just like reinforced this, you know, you've all heard like, if you build it, they will come. And I just had this idea at that time. I'm like, oh, this is so easy. Building stuff and putting it out in the market, it's so easy. Like, what are people getting all, you know, what are they getting all upset about? It's so easy. And then like our experience with DevTable and Quay, it fixed that very quickly. When you're trying to sell things to businesses, people don't have a lot of time, don't have a lot of attention. Selling a productivity tool or an infrastructure tool is very different from selling a game or giving a game away for free, right? So that sort of like fixed my mentality about how easy it was to get people to use a thing. And ever since then, I've been kind of pro, like, let's make sure there's a business here. Let's make sure we're monetizing early. But to get back to your question about what's different this time around, everything. Everything is different this time around. So when we built Quay, we were a two-person company. We were focused on bootstrapping. We built a multi-tenant SaaS that everybody in the world could use, and we were just running one of them. Like I said, we didn't take any VC funding, and we were a two-person team. And it was a like, I think when we launched, it was $5 or $7. So it was like a credit card swipe, easy Stripe sale. This time around, everything is different. So this time we have VC funding. This time we have a bigger team. We're approaching a more audacious goal. We're open source much earlier this time around. It wasn't until well after the Red Hat acquisition that we actually open sourced Quay. So we're open source much earlier. So just everything is different from the business model to the fundraising, to the team structure, to the ideals. I think we're trying to like speed run all of the different ways to build a company and try and see where the bounds of the solution space are.
What do you think is the future of permissioning as a service or products like this? Because I think we often see the value prop of this is really about like reducing the complexity, give you more like enterprise readiness, right? That's sort of like the main way you sell. But I feel like a lot of things, if you look at maybe the other counterpart of it's just Auth0 of the worlds, they start with a problem and they go pretty wide after that, right? All kinds of plugins, all kinds of stuff. Where do you think permissioning goes? Like what do you see the feature of this will go afterwards?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of work to do before we've tapped out how a company can use better authorization to build delightful experiences for their customer, right? Ultimately, that's the goal, is to help them build those experiences and get to market faster. So anything that we can build in that realm, things that we can build to make it easier to use, things that we can build to make the onboarding easier or faster, or make the modeling easier to understand or more reliable, more robust, eliminate foot guns, help our customers build the infrastructure that they need to consume our services, right? Like marry their infrastructure to our infrastructure. There's a lot of work to do there. So we're just going to keep doing that. And we're just going to keep marching down this path of like the best authorization that we can, as long as we can. And like, there are certain sort of natural adjacencies, right? Like products that use authorization at their core. They should probably be building on top of us. And so building out those kinds of relationships and getting those people invested in what we're doing and helping them be successful, that's kind of where we see this all going.
And you shared so many nuggets of wisdom for other founders throughout, but we love ending on this question. Any advice for founders that are like a couple steps earlier in their journey, or folks that are at companies thinking about starting an open source company? Like what are some big pieces of advice you'd leave them with?
Yeah, maybe this is not in the tone of the show, but I think you shouldn't set out to start an open source company. I think you should set out to solve a problem. And if open source is the right way to solve that problem and the right way to get into the market and the right way to get to your users, then open source is a tool in your tool belt. The same way like open source foundations are a tool. They have pros and cons. And you need to look at each of those things and say, you know, is this the best thing for my company at this time, in this place, in this ecosystem, with this customer archetype, and make your decision from there. So like, I guess I would just flip the whole question on its head and be like, if you're planning on being an open source founder, like you should rethink why. What is open source bringing to the table? And then build conviction around that and then go from there.
I love that. Know why open source is going to serve your community and your use cases. This is a terrific conversation. Thank you so much, Jake, for doing this with us.
Happy to be here. And I really enjoyed the conversation.